Broadcasting on the internet and at 90.1 FM from high atop Burnaby Mountain, you're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM.
Coastal Jazz is excited to announce the 39th year of the Vancouver International Jazz Festival. With over 150 performances and over 50 free events, running from June 21st to June 30th. Highlights of the festival include Downtown Jazz, a set of opening weekend concerts on June 22nd and June 23rd in front of the Vancouver Art Gallery. The hub of the event will be Granville Island, where you'll be able to see free and ticketed shows scheduled at the Performance Works, Ocean Artworks, and the Review Stage. Featured performances this year include The Mesthetics and James Brandon Lewis performing June 23rd at the Performance Works and Killer Mike performing June 29th at Queen Elizabeth Theatre. For more information and to purchase specific concert tickets, visit www.coastaljazz.ca. Oh my.
New Dimensions is brought to you by Friends of New Dimensions membership support and by Larson Publications, publisher of the book An Open Life, Joseph Campbell in conversation with Michael Toms. New Dimensions and our quarter-hour New Dimensions Cafe programs are now available worldwide as podcasts. You can find them at the iTunes Store and on many podcast sites and mobile apps. You can also find our podcasts and much more on our website, newdimensions.org. It is only through a change in human consciousness that the world will be transformed. The personal and the planetary are connected. As we expand our awareness of mind, body, psyche, and spirit, and bring that awareness actively into the world, so also will the world be changed. This is our quest as we explore new dimensions.
Our fears, let me count a few of them. Fear of change, fear of never changing, fear of responsibility, aging and illness, loss, failure, rejection, humiliation, fear for the planet, fear of missing out, fear of sounding stupid. The list goes on and on. Our fears may be rooted in big or small traumas haunting the past or challenges looming in the future. They cast their shadow over the smallest moments of everyday life. Our guest today observes, when we're not sure what to be afraid of, which threat to dodge next, and what direction it will come from, our fear mutates into free-floating anxiety. He goes on to point out, to soothe our anxiety, we might fall into addiction, take refuge in drug or drink, or in compulsive eating or gambling or gaming or hoarding or sex or cutting or starving ourselves, or in magical belief systems or bogus political messiahs. Anything that offers a shelter when we feel like we're going to fade away. Today we'll be exploring practical steps for navigating the free-floating anxiety of everyday fears and take a look at an unobstructed view of reality with our guest, Dean Slider. Dean Slider has taught natural methods of meditation and awakening throughout the United States and beyond since 1970. He's taught at colleges and yoga studios to corporate offices and maximum security prisons. He's known for his funny, down-to-earth style and for making life-transforming teachings accessible and easy. He's the author of many books, including Cinema Nirvana, Enlightenment Lessons from the Movies, Natural Meditation, A Guide to Effortless Meditative Practice, and Fearless, Living Beyond Fear, Anxiety, Anger, and Addiction. Join us for the next hour as we explore the practical ways of dissolving the roots of fear, anxiety, anger, and addiction with our guest, Dean Slider. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. I'll be your host. Welcome to New Dimensions. And I want to tell our listeners before we begin, just those who are listening on the radio, Dean Slyter spells his last name S-L-U-Y-T-E-R. That's S-L-U-Y-T-E-R, Dean Slyter. Dean, welcome to New Dimensions.
Thanks so much. It's really great to be back here again.
It's so great to have you back here again, Dean. And, you know, we got to start off with meditation. Why is meditation important?
Well, you're right. Meditation is the core practice. And as I emphasized in my previous book, Natural Meditation, people think of it as, oh, you've got to clear your mind, you have to concentrate, you have to push away thoughts. I know it would be healthy for me to do, but it's too hard. So I stress that it's actually when someone shows you how to just stop pushing and allow yourself to be pulled, we could say, it's actually very easy. And what happens then is we sink into ourselves. All the great sages, all the great masters have pointed out that we keep looking for the solution to the problem of human life, the basic existential problem of human life, which is that, A, we're scared, there's a lot of scary stuff out there, and B, we're hungry. We're, as human beings, we have the curse and the blessing of a feeling that, well, there's something more, even when I'm healthy and I'm well fed and all that. What is that something more? And they point out that the solution to both of those problems, the answer to both of those questions, is inside of us, whether they call it the kingdom of heaven within, whether they call it nirvana. You find it by turning within. You're not going to find it anywhere outside yourself. And that's what meditation does. It allows us to settle into ourselves, into that place of, for lack of a better word,
I recall something that you said in your book. It may not refer exactly to this, but life's a practice fire drill.
Yeah. What I say, and I say that in regard to all of the methods in the book, is you want to do the drill before the fire.
Yes.
Right. So
you want to know where the exit is.
You want to know where the fire exit is. You want to be able to find that in the dark. For example, one very simple method that I give in the book, and in fact, this chapter was just excerpted on Oprah.com.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you.
People can look for that one.
Right. And the chapter is titled very simply, Breathe Through Your Feet. And the chapter is about 2 pages long. And what I suggest that people do is, and actually anyone listening to this can try this right now, is simply, as you're breathing in, imagine that you're breathing in through the soles of your feet. As you're breathing out, imagine you're breathing out through the soles of your feet. Maybe you're breathing fast or slow, deep or shallow. Don't worry about that. Just take a few minutes and breathe in through the soles of your feet, breathe out through the soles of your feet. Now, when you do that, You'll discover whatever you'll discover. I can't tell you what will your experience is your experience. But what people keep telling me and what I've experienced is you can't be totally caught up in anything when you're breathing through your feet. So that, for example, here's a kind of fire that can happen is you're driving and someone cuts you off and you find yourself about to go into a very foolish road rage situation. And instead, you take a moment, okay, breathe through my feet. I've done this drill before. I know how to do this. And you can't be completely caught up in road rage if you do that. If you're tossing and turning at night, what do I do? I'm just, try breathing through your feet. I actually just got an email from a reader that said, I've started breathing through my feet at night. This method is going to put Ambien out of business.
Oh, nicely done. Nicely done. Yes. I don't know if this has anything to do with it. I was with my women's group yesterday, and we light a candle and call in some quality, each one of us. Mm. And what I called in was groundedness.
Mm.
And it just seems to have something to do with breathing through your feet, mm-hmm. for me at least. Mm-hmm. I mean, something about just connecting us with something large and expansive and will hold me or that which I am held by. What am I trying to say?
You're trying to say Dharma. And yeah, I know, Justine, that you've got a strong background in the Buddhist teachings, and that in the Buddhist world, they don't use the word Buddhism. They use the word Dharma. And Dharma comes from the root dhri, which means to hold up. And usually you'll see this word Dharma explained as that which is upheld. In other words, these are the doctrines. We uphold these doctrines. But I interpret it, I'm not a scholar of Sanskrit, but this is the way I interpret it because it makes sense to me, is that it really means not that which we uphold, but that which holds up. That which, when you go through all the crap of life and the easy stuff and the hard stuff, it's kind of, I think of it like panning for gold. When all the dross, all the pebbles wash away, what remains there? What's the gold, the precious stuff that holds up? And yeah, that's the thing. And especially as we have more experience in life, we get older, we experience illness, we experience, you know, marriages that succeed or fail. We experience sometimes what's going on with our kids, if we have them, is very easy and fulfilling. And sometimes it's really, really trying. What is it that is there all the time? What can we absolutely rely on? And again, what all the sages tell us is that there, as we're experiencing all these things that come and go, that rise and fall, that are great, that are not so great, we're experiencing it from a usually overlooked place of perfect delicious silence, which is actually what we are in our deepest core. Usually we overlook that because we get distracted by all the shiny objects, the good and the bad shiny objects. We get caught up in stuff. And then we come to define our lives in terms of how things work out with that stuff. And when it seems like, oh, that stuff is not going to work out, then we have fear. When we've gotten batted around by enough of those things, we have free-floating anxiety. When we think, oh, I think I've identified the person or the situation responsible for things not working out, we wind up in anger. When we get overwhelmed by any of these, we wind up in addiction, whether it's, addiction to Oreos or addiction to heroin or addiction to abusive lovers, whatever it is. So all these maladies of life, these existential maladies that seem so different, it sounds like an oversimplification. But somehow, whether it's Jesus or the Buddha or Al-Halaj or Socrates or Lao Tzu or the Baal Shem Tov, from all these traditions, they all say, settle down within yourself. That silence is there. All this stuff tossing and turning on the waves, the surface of life, that tosses and turns. Don't try to flatten out all the waves. That's a hopeless task. But if you can settle down just a foot or two into the water beneath the waves, it's already always silent. And that's what you are, and anyone can access it.
Is meditation, some people will practice it as a kind of time out from the challenges of life and just all those challenges that you were talking about. So we meditate as a timeout, but you're saying it's something much more than that. It's getting in touch with that, I want to say, luminous silence.
I guess
the two words that I would put together, that it's silence alone for me. Sounds a little bit scary, but luminous silence, it's like a very like dynamic place, but yet it's still silent.
One of the best descriptions, maybe the best description I've ever heard, was from my old teacher, Maharishi Mahesh Yogi.
We're going to have that quote in just one moment. I'm so sorry. I want to remind our listeners that I'm here with Dean Slider, and he is the author of Fearless, Living Beyond Fear, Anxiety, Anger, and Addiction. And if you want to know more about his work, you can go to his website, fearlessbook.net, or you can get there through the New Dimensions website, newdimensions.org. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You're listening to New Dimensions. Here with Dean Slider. He is the author of Fearless, Living Beyond Fear, Anxiety, Anger, and Addiction. And Dean, you were just going to give us a quote from one of your teachers.
Right. My first really serious meditation teacher, Maharishi Mahesh Yogi. Maharishi used to say things, because I was one of his teachers, and he would say certain things over and over again to make sure, and these things I know now, you know, whatever it is, 40 years later.
He trained you to be a teacher,
yes.
So to speak.
Yes. But this thing I only heard him say once. It was we were in Fuji, Italy, and he was trying to describe that place, which is not a place, that core of life, that core of existence, which we settle into in meditation. And he was looking for words, and he was having trouble finding words. And finally he said, "It's just nothing, but there's something very good about it."
So that kind of goes back to my luminous silence.
Yes.
It's just nothing, but something is very good about it.
Yes. You know, in the Buddhist world, they use this term emptiness a lot. And people hear that and they think, oh, emptiness, this is like the existential void, and it's terrifying and it's awful and all that. But that's not empty. That's they're filling that up with their ideas of voidness. You know, if we have to use the term empty, I would think of I don't know if people will like this example, but you know when you have a really great bowel movement?
Everybody's had that experience.
Yes.
We
and
can all relate.
Oh, you just, it's all of a sudden, the air is clearer,
yeah.
The sun, the birds are singing.
Right.
You feel deliciously
you are
empty.
You're successful.
Yeah. Yes, something analogous to that. But the thing is that everyone who experiences this, and you don't have to be an ancient sage, anyone who practices the ease of natural meditation, allowing themselves to just settle into this, will get some glimpse of it, and then the glimpses get clearer and they last for longer. And eventually, the whole idea is that you're living from there all the time. The whole point of meditation is to not have to meditate anymore. And what everyone experiences is, oh yeah, this is what I was looking for everywhere else. No one who experiences what we're talking about says, okay, I experienced it, but I didn't like it. It's not for me. Because it is what we are. It is home. And this is another way we can understand this. Why is it, what is the common root of fear, anxiety, anger, and addiction? They're all symptoms of what we could call a deep state of homelessness.
Mm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
where I live in Santa Monica, and especially a few blocks away in Venice, mm-hmm. there's a lot of homeless people mm-hmm. living on the streets. And in a way, they're profound teachers to me of what is going on with us, we could say spiritually or existentially, when we are not experiencing what we are at the deepest level. We're not experiencing what we are. We're not experiencing this silent awareness itself, which is like the mirror that reflects all the experiences that we're aware of. Then we get caught up in all those experiences and trying to arrange our happiness and in terms of those things that are always moving parts and ultimately ungovernable. And so naturally, not being home, not being in this place of, I've come back, here I am, this is where I belong. When we don't have that, anytime you're uprooted from home, you're susceptible to fear, anxiety, anger, and then the addictive cravings, you know, with which we try to self-medicate, to soothe those things.
Okay, now, Dean, if we practice this and we experience it and we bring it into our life, however, you know, several times a day, or mm-hmm. we have it in our lives on occasion, we're getting better and better at it. Does this take us out of the activity of participating in life? Does this take us out of that?
No, quite the opposite. In fact, the classic text of meditation and action in Indian tradition is the Bhagavad Gita, where all the teachings are given not to a monk in a cave, they're given to a warrior on the battlefield just before the battle begins, you know, and that's us. We're in the battlefield of life. The thing is, I mean, for instance, if you think of the really great social activists, the ones who've really changed the world, you think of Dr. King, Nelson Mandela, Gandhi, they're not people who were stressed. They're not people who were all wound up in the way, you know, some social activists are. My parents were political activists. All their friends were. I grew up seeing their meetings in my living room. And at a pretty young age, I started to figure out, how are these people going to create peace in the world when they don't have peace in themselves?
Because they were very agitated in their activity.
Exactly.
Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. When you are coming from that place of silence, you're more effective. You have greater clarity. You don't get caught up in stuff. One of the chapters in the book is titled, Would It Help? The 2015 Steven Spielberg film, Bridge of Spies, true story of Rudolf Abel, the Soviet spy who was captured in New York City and put on trial for his life. Fortunately, in the film, his lawyer is Tom Hanks. Mm-hmm. So you think probably things are going to turn out okay. And in their first jailhouse meeting, the lawyer says to him, you know, the Americans and the Soviets, you're very inconvenient for both of them. Both sides would like to see you in the electric chair. And Rudolf Abel, played by the great Mark Rylance, who won an Oscar mm-hmm. for this part, he considers that for a moment, and then he says, all right. And the lawyer says, you don't seem worried. And he considers that for a moment, and then he says with a little shrug, would it help? Yeah, and that thing is like a sword. That would it help? That is the sword of discrimination. How much of the running around like chickens with our heads cut off, how much of the Facebook tirades, how much of the, you know, yelling at the TV news, how much of that helps? How much of it makes life better? How much of it reduces suffering for ourselves and others? And how much of it is just useless at best and counterproductive at worst?
So, Dean, that takes me to another story. Tell us the story of Miles Davis and Herbie Hancock.
Right. So young Herbie was playing with Miles and a lineup of just all-star jazz greats in Stuttgart in, I think, 1960-something. And they're cooking along. Everything's going great. And Herbie hits a completely wrong chord. You know, he's a great keyboard player. And he hits a chord that is disastrously wrong. And I believe he clapped his hands over his own ears in horror. Miles, without missing a beat, plays a solo, taking the notes of that wrong chord and making them right, weaving them into what they were playing. That is just, I mean, that's how you do it. Whatever life, exactly as you were saying, whatever life throws at you, you can say, this is wrong. There's no way to deal with this. You can clap your hands over your ears and just go, ah, or you can say, okay, now it's time for my solo. It's always time for our solo.
Yeah, but the trick was that Miles was master of his instrument.
Yes.
And that's where the meditation comes in for me, is that, hey, you can't expect it to be there if you haven't done your scales, so to speak, practiced. Would you agree with that?
And again, that brings us back to you got to do the fire drill before the fire. You know, toward the end of the book, when we start getting into some of the heavier stuff, I have a chapter about death, which is obviously a big topic of fear for a lot of people. And I give some procedures, and you know from your reading in the Tibetan Book of the Dead that all the great spiritual traditions have procedures. They have some kind of narrative. You're not just thrown in there and they say, okay, you know, good luck, fella. Like, okay, here is the way to do it that is of letting go of the body, letting go of the environment, letting go of your old identity as all those things slip away. There's an optimal way to do it. So I give some of that and some breathing procedures that can be helpful with that. But again, you don't want to wait until you're, you know, lying there in the hospital bed, breathing your last. It's good to practice this stuff. I do want to mention that the title of that chapter is The Valley of the Shadow. You know, that's taken from the psalm. Lo, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death. And the really interesting thing there, which I got from one of my teachers, is that it's not the valley of death. It's the valley of the shadow of death. It's not, we think we're scared of death, but it's actually impossible to be scared of death because there is no such experience as death. There is no such experience as death. There is only the anticipation, the mental shadow, the emotional shadow that throws on us. And that's going on right now. So that's something that we can deal with. That's something we can get a handle on.
And I think that you mentioned, because in your own lifetime, you had a very, very devastating death in your lifetime of your first wife, Maggie. Mm-hmm. And you were with her during her dying. And she mentioned to you at some point, in fact, I think you said you gave her an A for her.
Yeah.
Her
it's the final exam. Dying's the final exam.
Final exam, she gets an A.
She got an A.
And she said something like, how do people do that who are not meditators?
She was dealing with cancer, and she said, yeah, how do people who don't meditate deal with this? And yeah, I just shrugged. I said, I don't know. The other really interesting thing that we'll get to.
I'm here with the time just keeps going away from me. Wow, I can't believe it. I'm here with Dean Slider. He's the author of Fearless, Living Beyond Fear, Anxiety, Anger, and Addiction. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You're listening to New Dimensions.